Hi there, this is Carla Owen, Chief Executive of Animal Free Research UK, and this is my Animal Free Labcast, the show dedicated to a kinder, modern science that puts humans at the heart of medical research. Today, I'm talking with Sophie O'Kane, who's just finishing off her PhD in cognitive neuroscience at the prestigious Karolinska Institutet in Sweden. Sophie is one to watch. She's recipient of our inaugural Animal Free Research Early Career Scientist Award, and her enthusiasm and commitment to pursuing an animal-free research career really shines through, as you'll hear in our conversation. We'll hear all about how Sophie's Aunt Bev challenged her to question the status quo that animal research is the gold standard, sparking her own personal paradigm shift and passionate advocacy for animal-free research. I'll be asking Sophie about her fascinating research into how our brains construct our sense of who we are, and how perceptual illusions, like the rubber hand experiment you might have seen on YouTube, are helping patients. So Sophie, thank you so much for joining me today on the Animal Free Labcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you start off by just telling listeners who you are and where you work?
So my name's Sophie. I'm originally from Leeds in the UK, and I've been studying neuroscience, psychology. It'd be 10 years now, actually, and I'm coming to the end of my PhD. So I'm doing that at the Karolinska Institutet in Stockholm, Sweden. And it's all about brain, body and self. How does our brain construct a sense of who we are? And we do that using multisensory body illusions. So we take, if you are my participant, I'd invite you in, give you a VR headset, you put this on and see a mannequin's body from the first person perspective. And then we would administer some sort of tactile stimulation. So big balls on sticks will start to stroke the plastic body. And if I do this to your real body at the same time, in the same place, most likely you experience an illusion that that body is yours.
I've seen those videos, the rubber hand video, and then and you spoke very beautifully at our conference and showed the videos of that. It's quite freaky.
It's amazing to think as well that so we do this illusion, we can ask people what they think, but a really good piece of evidence would be that if you present a threat only to the mannequin's body, so a knife maybe in the VR video attacking the plastic body, you know it's not yours, but we can't help but feel and unconsciously produce a reaction as if it was. So it's a really, I think you've got to see it to believe it. And it really works strongly on me. So it's quite a lot of fun when we help each other out and try new illusions. And I'm always the go-to for feeling it quite strong. So it's a lot of fun.
I feel it just watching it on YouTube.
Yes, exactly. Well, some,
yeah. When I've seen those rubber hand on and the rubber hand gets stabbed and you're like, oh.
Yeah.
So, Sophie, for people who don't know then, Karolinska, I'm not going to be able to pronounce this, Institutet.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
It's one of the world-leading universities, isn't it, for the kind of research that you're doing?
Yeah, it really is. It's like one of the most prestigious medical research institutes in the whole world. And I've done my journey completely without animals, non-human animals. But it is also Europe's largest rodent facility. So we are surrounded right. by labs doing animal research. And it's always this environment that's quite hard when you feel so strongly about animal free, perhaps, and you just see that maybe, if we don't have to use it, I never have had to, surely that should be more possible, perhaps, especially with the evidence we have today about the wider use of animals and where that has maybe not led us.
So, Sophie, you're really passionate about this issue and about animal free research. Mm. And I should say you are our inaugural Early Careers Scientist Award winner. So congratulations on that.
Thank well you done. So much.
We were really impressed with both the research that you're doing, and we're going to dive into that in a bit, but also about the advocacy work and the voice that you've been in, you know, what has sometimes been maybe a challenging environment. It's hard to be, you know, one of the only voices standing up for animal-free research when animal research still is the norm.
Absolutely.
So what got you started on that journey? Why are you so passionate about this?
Yeah, well, for me, it was all thanks to my Aunt Bev. So shout out to Beverly Andrews. She'll be listening. The point is, though, we had a very pivotal conversation in the back of a car on the way to a gig with my family. And she was sort of, yeah, asking me straight up, are you going to be using animals in your research, or is it big where you go? And just very straight up about maybe that's not very helpful for human, for neuroscience in humans. So in that moment, I actually will confess, I defended animal research as I had just done my bachelor's. Mm-hmm. And you really are brought up to believe strongly that they have to be doing it where it's only relevant to human health. It's only really important, and that, you know, we have absolutely no other way. So I actually have to confess in that moment, I defended it.
So Sophie, just to interrupt mm-hmm. there, like... I hope you don't mind me saying you're quite young. So is that still the case then? So, you know, you've been, you're coming towards your PhD, but you've done your undergraduate within the last 6 years, I'm guessing,
yes.
Something like that. So even now, it's still being taught, or you're still coming out of the other end of your degree thinking animal research is the gold standard, this is the way we should be doing things.
I feel very strongly that's the attitude, yeah, because this conversation, when I went home later, I actually felt that I had parroted a narrative and that I wanted to do some research on my own time just to actually make a better argument for the animal researchers the next time I would speak with Bev. That's when I have to confess, I mean, wow, it was really... just going through all these meta-analyses that posit around 92 to 96% of animal experiments fail to give us any clear benefit in a human and might cause harm. I really reflected on all this and came to the conclusion that maybe what we are taught and what we are believed to be, to be that gold standard might actually not be right. And that was quite, a difficult thing if you think that you really have to question whether maybe you're going crazy, or because how can they all be wrong and tell you one thing, and how can the evidence be saying another? So this is really what started everything for me, was this chat with Bev, where I confess I tried to defend them, felt actually I'm going to go home and find a better answer, couldn't find one, and now I'm compelled to be part of animal-free research and advocating for the change, because I think that was my big revelation, epiphanic moment, perhaps.
Oh, well done, Auntie Bev.
Yeah, she is a legend.
So for you then, Sophie, it sounds like it was an evidence-based change of heart.
Exactly.
So it was the evidence that changed your heart, your mind, however you would phrase that. Was there a particular piece of evidence of something that you particularly read that really struck a chord with you?
Yeah, so when I was delving into Google Scholar trying to find any piece of evidence about this, I thought, again, as we're taught, the gold standard in evidence quality is meta-analysis, meta-review, where they take not just a single experiment, but they discuss an amalgamation of a large amount. And through this, you can see the outcomes of these studies is that 92 to 96% of animal experiments actually fail to give rise to any clear human benefit. And I see this as, because it can be direct harm if you think about the cases of drug-induced liver toxicity. So there was a great paper recently, Dr. Uwet et al. In Nature 2022. There's all these pieces of evidence saying to me you've got either direct harm because of the testing in animals failing to give you a good idea of how that drug will react in a human, but also indirectly, if we're so intent on carrying on doing what we're doing in animal models, we're indirectly harming because we're not changing track and actually finding better models. And for me, this is what it comes down to. Non-human animal models are not good models of humans. And for me, with neuroscience, I think there's a great couple of examples with that, where they study, for example, post-mortem tissue from a human and the cell electrophysiology, so how these cells operate, sort of the physics of those cells. It's actually very different in the human brain. So I'm thinking everything I've learned in my bachelor's, it's all perfectly applicable to a mouse, but I'm interested in the human brain. That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure it's, there's so much evidence out there now. I don't think we can deny that it's a possibility to argue animal research causes more harm than good to humans at this point. And then it comes a bit deeper for me if we think that ethics, ethical, so this was actually taught to me by the ethics department here at Karolinska in a lecture. They say you know, the scientific value justifies the immoral act of using animals in the first place. So the whole point that we have the ethics is to, you know, try and make an immoral act morally justifiable, but that is right. completely reliant on the scientific value. If you don't have a good scientific value, I don't even see why we would bother discussing the ethics, because it's just, it's redundant in that case.
Well, that's interesting that you're taught it's science first and then use the ethics to justify, because my instinct is definitely it's ethics first. That's where I come from.
Exactly. But when I've asked scientists, framing it in that way, an anonymous professor replied to me, instead of putting science first and then ethics second, they put ethics first, which isn't the correct philosophical, that's not how I, as we've been taught, believe it should progress. But they argue, well, we'll put ethics first and say we can't do this in a human, so we must do it in an animal. But if that isn't right model, well, they do get some bits of hope. We do have medicines and we ought to be obviously grateful for those. But I always liken it to a broken clock. Even a broken clock is correct twice a day. And we want a clock that's correct whole day long if possible.
Absolutely. So how then have you taken this forward into your research, Sophie?
Yeah, well, for me, I've always been animal free by being interested in the human brain. And I did my master's then in neuroimaging, which was focusing not just on functional magnetic resonance imaging. So taking the big magnets brain scanner, but also electroencephalography, where we can put electrodes on people. That's a big word. Electroencephalography. That's where we put electrodes on participants' heads and then we can record brain activity that way. But there's also examples where you can do single cell recording in patients undergoing surgery. So there's so many ways you can do human relevant, but it's not, it doesn't seem to be the majority. The majority feels very animal based and the science community really cling to that still being, if I may use Professor Ritskis-Heutinger's words, a regime.
So without them being too graphic, Sophie, if you or another researcher wasn't doing the research that you're doing in a human relevant way, using human brains in an ethical way, what would you be doing? Or what are other people doing? You said using mice and rats, monkeys.
It's almost like going around the whole animal kingdom until we find a good model. But the point is, all the models are non-human animal. And I don't see why we should just go around the animal kingdom until we hit gold. It should be that we, try and revolutionise the way of thinking and head toward novel alternative methods that are intrinsically human relevant from design. Because we can never get around species-species differences, I argue. But with advancing tech and innovative thinking, we can improve always technologies that can be human relevant. But I find it hard to know how one could ever circumvent species-to-species differences. So I try my best to communicate this and try and initiate that dialogue with the science community. But this is, I have to say, the biggest challenge. And I do all of this advocacy on the side of my work. So I'm not using mice or things like this, but I am within Europe's largest rodent facility. So there's a lot of opportunities to make the case for animal-free research and try and open a dialogue. But when I have really tried to do this, an anonymous professor replied, this was actually directly in my suggestion to pitch the idea of having a collaboration with Animal Free Research UK perhaps, and having seminars that actually invite speakers and scientists to get together and really start to discuss replacement, because we need it scientifically. But the response is, part of the response was no, because it will hurt our feelings. It will hurt scientists' feelings. And I found that, it's an absolute sadness, because obviously I'm so sorry to hurt your feelings, but that's not a scientific argument with respect. And also sometimes in life, the most difficult conversations are the most important. So that has inspired me to keep going, but it also shows me how this is a far more complex issue than it maybe should be. And it really involves human feelings.
Yeah. And it's not the case that for many people it is an evidence-based decision, like it was for you. I think you're quite rare in that, Sophie, because the evidence is there, as you've seen. Yeah. If it was just about the evidence, things would have changed much more by now.
Yeah.
So what have you found in your journey so far is the most effective way of talking with people who've got different perspectives?
Well, yeah, that's still something I'm trying to mature and develop. I think it is difficult when you are trying to say what you've got to say, but there is obviously a larger psychological battle going on. And I think for me, the best way I've seen, actually, I will shout out for Pepik Henneman from the conference recently, yes. Absolutely adored these replacement helpathons. So this is obviously part of the Transition Programme for Innovation, the Dutch initiative, which is nationwide, if I understand. And it's about inviting medical researchers to ask how they can innovate methods in an animal-free way and how we can get everyone together in a very respectful, positive environment where we can all, you know, try and ask each other, actually, how can we help you? You want to, because they also say, the same professors when I've asked, I can quote them as saying, you know, we would love to not use animals. We have to, but we would love for there to be any other way. So if we can cling to that, it seems that we just need to have that environment and those initiatives going on to allow this to allow this dialogue to take place in a respectful way where no one's feeling, you know, hostile or no one's feeling threatened. It's all about we just want the best for each other and for science to progress as it ought to.
And that's so important because it's such an emotive issue still, as you are finding. And the helpathons are great. So for people who don't know, I talk about this quite a lot. The Netherlands is quite far ahead of us in terms of the transition to animal-free research, partly because it's been backed by the government and this transition program initiative. And the helpathons, we brought the helpathons to the UK. We had the first UK helpathon last October, and it was a real education for me because they've really got it much more nailed in having those adult mature conversations where we're much more open with each other and it's about having a dialogue about how we can help rather than blame.
And I think you can really absolve individuals after I've been in this environment. I think it's just very obvious that people just either go along with it or, you know, there's many reasons people do what they do. It's fascinating. It's why partly I'm fascinated by the human brain. Because the same information, different people can come to different conclusions. But yeah, these helpathons, absolutely love them. And yeah, it's fantastic that they are, they're nationwide in Holland, but now also coming to the UK. And then also, actually, I have to share some excellent, exciting news, which is that I'm now, through Pepik, in connection with a lady from Jordbruksverket, or the Swedish 3R Centre. And actually, we're going to be, hopefully having a digital meeting in the next few weeks to discuss how to get helpathons going here. And my contact in the animal welfare body for Karolinska has been very positive in saying could host that. So this sounds excellent. It's really exciting.
It's really
time.
Good news, Sophie. Well done. Well done. That's brilliant.
I think it's all thanks to the helpathon initiative. It's just, I think, perfect. And might even be approaching or coming to KI soon, to the Karolinska soon.
Fantastic. Yeah. Fabulous. Well done. Please consider making a donation to Animal Free Research UK today. Your support fuels our mission and means science wins, patients win, and animals win too. Please visit animalfreeresearchuk.org/donate. So thinking about your work then, your research for a minute, what can you tell us what impact you're hoping to have for patients in a human relevant way?
Yes, so I'll start by explaining. So I'm doing a cognitive neuroscience. So we examine healthy human participants who have no ailments of any, we ask for people who are not on medicines or healthy individuals. And we study the malleability of the sense of bodily self with such perceptual illusions. But the idea is that when we examine the healthy population, it's the cognitive neuroscience, but this is informative for the clinical neuroscience. It's all kind of a spectrum. If you understand the system in health, it'll help you understand what might go wrong for people who are suffering with a sense of bodily, either a sense of disownership for one of their limbs. This would be applying to somatoparaphrenia. Patients who have had a stroke can sometimes report a very bizarre sensation that their left arm does not belong to them, which is very bizarre, but that also shows you the brain must be having to piece this together. It's not an innate, it's not a given that this body belongs to you. Your brain has to combine the senses in some way from that limb to give yourself this internal bodily model. But also, that's for a body part, but then thinking about whole body ownership or disownership, this is more applicable in psychiatry. There's some discussion with post-traumatic stress disorder and how they also alienate from their own body. So these are all very, very novel areas to apply the research, but it's sort of, there are many, many different medical conditions that seem to apply or have involved a sense of a bodily component. When we understand the system in health, it's to also try and help the information for those systems when they break down due to stroke or psychiatric illness.
So, Sophie, just to kind of circle back then, this is about the rubber hand, stabbing the rubber, rubber hand. That's how all this relates back.
Yes, exactly. So when we're trying to understand how is a healthy human participant able to embody a rubber hand, we also use MRI. We want to also try and image the brain whilst these subjective feelings occur so that we can relate those feelings to brain activation and hopefully inform where those systems break down for patients with, for example, somatoparaphrenia and other disorders of bodily ownership.
So you're trying to look for where in the brain kind of has control or ownership of those body parts.
Exactly, yeah.
And with the ultimate goal then of helping people with stroke who have got kind of some strange sensations, who maybe feel like they don't own their limbs anymore, to try and retrain the brain?
Yeah, there are some thoughts to this, but there are so many applications, even if you think about prosthetic limbs and how if we have a prosthetic limb that actually you can also control, but also gives you, with a feedback, some sense of, aha, that is my hand. This is also, part of the application, theoretically.
So it strikes me that trying to conduct that research on any species other than humans is utter madness.
Well, absolutely, because in our case, the subjective report is vital. We ask you to tell us, do you feel the illusion? Yeah. And we ask people to rate all kinds of things on scales, but that's a really critical part, especially if you think back to the patients in clinics. They are going because they have a subjective change in their sense of bodily ownership. It's a very, there's a psychological component that shouldn't really be ignored. But when we see, for example, there are papers in the field for rubber tail illusion in mice just a lot of, it just feels very unnecessary. It's hard to motivate these studies over existing ethical alternatives, or it should be. That's, the crux of it. And also the macaque monkey, there's a lot of our understanding that comes from, these studies about multisensory integration and binding. But if you can't ask the animal how it perceives its own body, I don't think personally that you can ethically motivate these studies at all.
Absolutely. Sophie, it strikes me that you are a very diplomatic person in your communications. So what are the, which is great to see, and I really think is the best way to try to communicate with people. So what are your next steps then? How are you going to continue this journey? Is this something that you is a lifelong journey for you? Do you want to keep on challenging and speaking up with all the consequences that maybe comes for you from that?
Oh, 100%. No problem. But right now, my main focus is to finish my PhD. That's hoping I'll have my defence in January. So it's all, as you can imagine, and all the other PhD students out there. It's, you know, heavy time. All systems go. Thank you to Monster Energy Drinks for keeping me going.
Other energy drinks are available.
Another energy drink, all the energy drinks. Yes, thank you to Energy Drinks for keeping me going. But yeah, once this is complete, I just want to dedicate, my life to this. I live and breathe it. It's, you know, I do my work and then all night long I might be researching this type of thing, and just be would be great to formalize this. But it seems I have become somewhat of the unofficial ambassador for animal-free research. And I'm having students reach out to me, even master's students in pharmacology here at KI, and they want to know, is there a network for scientists who want to move away from the animal models, animal-based techniques, and actually just push for more sustainable science in general? So I'm going to be meeting with them outside of working hours in the next few few days, actually. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a really exciting time to carry on, because now it really, with the Dutch Transition Programme for Innovation, we've got like a real international family now that's sort of completely behind this movement. And actually, I think because the students themselves, like myself, we're actually asking for that change, I think that's got a really high chance of, making things move in the right direction.
So do you see, Sophie, that young scientists who are kind of just coming up through the kind of career, or through the education system, do you see that there's more people, more interested in this now than maybe there was even when you were doing it?
Definitely, yes. But it still is, I would say, a minority. But this is the thing again with psychology and brains on legs. I always quote one of my all-time favourite studies, because it's just, again, you have to see it to believe it, really. It's Ashe's Lines, 1955. Where in this study they bring in, so if you're the participant, you'd come in, you'd find a room full of other participants, or that's what you think. They're actually actors, and the trick's going to be you're going to be shown a little line and a big line, and essentially you've got to say which of the two is bigger. So it's the most simple, obvious answer in the world out of two lines, which is bigger, which is smaller. But 75% of people in that situation follow the crowd and will actually agree that the little line is bigger than the big line. It's,
my goodness,
it's absolutely astounding.
That's staggering.
75% of people will see an obvious fact and will agree with the majority. So I think, it all comes, for me, everything comes down to psychology. We are just brain on legs trying to do what we think to be right. And we all have a justification for everything. But, getting groups of people with different perspectives to work together, we have to figure out how to, get through a few psychological hurdles maybe on that journey.
So obviously that is the million-dollar question, Sophie. Have you got thoughts about how we might achieve that?
So for me, as I'm, I'd like to think I'm a scientist, and these guys are obviously, the world's best. If we can talk in a common language and just keep to science and models, this is a language that we can all, speak in. And if I, one of the sort of quotes I cling to is the George Box, 1976, statistician, who said, "All models are wrong, but some are useful." And my question to anyone and everyone I can access is simply, are animal models useful enough? Are they useful? And do we have alternatives? Could they be better due to being intrinsically human relevant? I think just trying to keep it scientific is one angle, to stick to the evidence and, really try and push that that narrative, just really black and white. But of course, everyone has their own perspective on the issue. So how to bring all these minds together? I have to say, again, the helpathon, just about bringing people together who don't usually want to have these discussions or might be afraid to have these discussions. It's just about really establishing a safe space for those to occur, and then absolutely to shift it away from, blame and all this type of thing. It's to say, okay, well, you want to stop using animals, because I know for a fact if they all could, I think they would. Mm-hmm. It's just about helping that process. So it's a leap of faith on both sides, but it's to come together in that type of environment and say, okay, you want to replace animals, what do you need? And then it's building a network and building this with the students themselves. And as I say, I've got a lot of hope as I'm meeting with a few in the next few days, and it does seem the time is now to really, this can really happen. There's a lot of evidence to say that novel alternative methods give us far better results. And I think if we really care about science and just staying on this idea about finding the best model, we should be able to reach the same conclusion together, and we'll have faster or better medicines for humans faster.
One of the things that I talk about, Sophie, is paradigm change. Mm. And you had a paradigm shift when you talked to your Auntie Beth.
I did.
And that for you was, well, talking to somebody that you respected and loved, mm, and then going away and doing some research and finding your evidence, and then it happened like that, mm, I think, by the sounds of what you're saying. Lots of us have had those sorts of experiences, whether we're scientists or not, had that kind of, in the click of an eye, kind of the blinkers falling down and seeing the world in a different way. And so one of the challenges is to get more people to have those moments. Mm. How can we encourage and create that environment where we can help and encourage and support other people to see the world differently? That's one challenge. The other challenge, which is the harder challenge, is to get everyone, all of society, to actually see the world differently, see the world in the way that we see it. Mm. That's the million-dollar question. How do we achieve that? And I think, you know, evidence is a really important part of that, but it's also about the human relationships that you have and that you're forming as you have these conversations, as you're talking to the professors and your colleagues, mm, and the younger students coming up through. They will probably be convinced as much by you as by the evidence, by seeing that you are diplomatic and reasonable and thoughtful and caring and compassionate.
Well, thank you.
And thinking, oh, this is a person that I want to know and, you know, talk with and be like.
Thank you. Yeah, it's not been a very smooth journey. And I've also had to grow and learn. Definitely hold my hands up. Because sometimes you see 2 + 2 = 5, or to quote the McNamara fallacy, you know, people seem to be making the measurable important rather than the finding a way to make the important measurable. And you can, as I did, just feel very lost, actually. I felt almost betrayed, or, you know, really struggled for a little time to just balance my own emotions. But then breaking through that was one of the best things that ever happened, because you can only make a positive difference by being able to initiate conversations, or trying to. There's still been a difficulty, but it's because of their resistance. I think it's very true to say there's a regime against using the animal free, or to actually be outspoken about it. You do put yourself out there, and I'm surprised to be that person. It's not really my natural comfort zone, but I felt compelled to get involved. It was out of my control almost, and I think now it's a place where, which is fantastic. I am liaising with the comparative medicine animal welfare body, fantastic people, and everybody, we might not agree on everything, but there is a real awareness of the need to start going away from animal models. But that, it's a very difficult, still a very tense, difficult environment. But you just have to try and put yourself out there and take that leap of faith. And if you can do it, hope they can too.
You've mentioned the word regime a couple of times, Sophie. What do you mean by that in this context?
So here I will say, I'm using this word because that's the word used by Professor Meryl Ritzke's Heutinger when she gave her talk. I would say it is a paradigm, a way of thinking, and to challenge something that's the status quo. That can have, you know, a lot of, or can lead to a lot of resistance. So where it should be possible for scientists to ask other scientists questions about science and the evidence, and where it involves animal research, it doesn't seem those questions are allowed. There's a real feeling that you shouldn't be asking this, or you're not showing solidarity with scientists, or just simply, you can't do this. So it does feel that you really, you know, have to have a bit of courage to even say what you've got to say. But this is changing. I think it's changed a lot in the last 6 years that I've been here, and with continued amazing initiatives like Helpathons and just creating that right environment, hopefully they can be less defensive, but also trust that our movement isn't militant, but very compassionate. It's compassionate for them as much as anything else.
So Sophie, thinking about people at home, what can they do to make a difference? Because we're not all scientists.
Well, for me, the most pivotal conversation was the one in that car. So, like my Aunt Bev, if anyone out there has a niece or a nephew, a son or a daughter, or someone in the family who, yeah, you know, is doing scientific research, just go ahead and ask them. Are they using animals? Why? And what do they think about it? And, yeah, you never know.
You never know where that might lead.
Exactly.
So, Sophie, we always like to finish on a hopeful note. So looking forwards, what's your hope for the future? Where do you think this is all going?
Yeah, I think it really is very exciting and definitely inspired by the recent conference, the science conference. Absolutely fantastic. Hope to come every year. It really, there's
you.
A whole international family now, a lot of really fantastic people, fantastic scientists and business or private public sector. Everyone's getting involved now and really, it's just, I think, the best time. So for me, it's with the continued liaison between comparative medicine, animal welfare, so hopefully soon with the Swedish 3R Centre, getting students, everybody around a table to discuss, you know, this issue together in the spirit of the helpathons. That's what I see possibly happening in the near future here at KI even, but I shouldn't jinx it. But I'm certainly going to carry on going, and I think it looks really possible. There's a lot of scope for success just by how the students have been contacting me. I've yes somehow become the unofficial ambassador for all things animal free, and that's fantastic. I think it's really fantastic because I'm certainly not the first and I'm certainly not the last student who wants to ask those difficult questions and challenge the regime or the paradigm. Just challenge that.
Well, Sophie, thank you so much for joining me on the Animal Free Labcast today. Thank you for all that you're doing, for being part of the change that you want to see in the world. And congratulations again on being Animal Free Research UK's Early Career Scientist of 2023.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So much of the resistance to animal-free research is based on the status quo that animal use is the gold standard, and it's entrenched by the attitudes and emotions of the people involved. So my hat goes off to Sophie for breaking the mould and really looking closely at the evidence, which all points to the failings of animal research and the promise of animal-free research. It takes a huge amount of courage and energy to stand up for what you believe in, especially when you're surrounded by people who don't agree with you. To use your voice to speak truth to power. Sophie's a shining example of this, and I'm excited to see what she does next. The future is in the hands of passionate young researchers like her. Well, that's all we have time for in this episode of the Animal Free Labcast. In the next episode, I'll be chatting to Professor Matt Dalby about the Lifetime CDT. It's an amazing initiative we're so proud to support that's training 80 young innovation leaders in drug discovery using exciting animal-free technologies. If you've been inspired by this conversation and want to help, the best way to support us is by visiting animalfreeresearchuk.org/donate to make a donation if that's something you can do right now. Or if not, you'll find loads of other ways you can support medical research that's helping cure diseases faster without animal suffering. From me, Carla Owen, thanks so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please do share far and wide.